This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. We have a special bulletin here from the behind enemy lines. This is from the RNC, the email I got this morning from the RNC. The liberal circus is in town. Democrat leaders to pander to left-wing Take Back America Conference. These are the notes that went out to every talk show host in America this morning from the RNC, and it's just incredible. It's so long, Simon. I should scroll through and see, I'm looking to see if your name is on here. They got a whole thing about Code Pink, Medea Benjamin. Oh my God, she's going to be there.
They were just here a second ago.
Yeah, and singing their songs, and MoveOn.org is going to be there. And oh, this is terrible. This is
the vast left wing conspiracy.
What's incredible is that this news release from the RNC that's going out to all the right wing talk show hosts, frankly, kind of reads like a PR piece for what's going on. Anyhow, Simon Rosenberg with us here in our first segment. He's the president and founder of NDN, leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. NDN.
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, we're a think tank and advocacy organization, and what we're really focusing on, Tom, is that we think there are three big transformations happening in America today that are making the politics of the 21st century very different from the 20th century, and they are, a huge change in media and technology that's changing the way that we all communicate. Second is the people ourselves are changing. We've become more southern and western and suburban and exurban and Hispanic and Asian and all these things. And finally, that there's an emerging new governing agenda that speaks to the challenges we face today and not the past. And so we're doing intellectual work in these three areas, right, about new media technology, new people, new governance. And second of all, we also become one of the largest media producers in the family. We've done about $10 million worth of paid advertising the last several elections. And, we're just trying to advance the progressive cause. Well, we, in 2004 and 2006, we ran a total of about $8 million in Spanish. We are now the largest communicator in Spanish of any group in American politics, including the RNC, your friends.
Well, the RNC, they're sponsoring right-wing talk show hosts on local stations all over the country.
Yeah.
It's really flying below everybody's radar.
Bush was very smart. When it comes to Hispanics, if you want to talk about this for a second, Hispanics are the fastest growing part of the American electorate. Mm-hmm. In my lifetime, it'll be 25% of the American electorate. And Bush doubled their market share from 21% in 1996 to 40% in 2004. Really significant political achievement. And what happened in 2006, it spelled trouble for progressives and Democrats.
Well, he doubled the number of Hispanic Protestants. Or evangelicals, evangelical Catholics.
It was everybody.
But the Protestant share the evangelical share of the Hispanic vote
dramatically. But they had dramatic impact, and
the Republicans.
Yeah, and a lot of where the vote came from was with immigrants. About half of the Hispanic electorate today is foreign-born and still retains some Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we've been working on with folks like Bob Menendez and Ken Salazar and Antonio Villagrosa and others is that, our basic argument is that if we want to be a majority party and movement in the 21st century, we have to become bilingual and bicultural. Mm-hmm. It's about, those who speak Spanish are now about 4 to 5% of the American electorate. It's really amazing.
And
4 to 5% of the American electorate. Yeah. And, we can't leave those folks out of the great discourse that's democracy. And so we've been really trying to pioneer and teach the movement about how to, do an old thing in a new way, which is, speak to this largely the Hispanic immigrants. And the good news is the immigration debate and the sort of anger of the language and the discourse on the immigration debate has really alienated Hispanics from the Republican Party, unraveling the great gains that Bush made and energizing this electorate. Hispanics went from 6% of the electorate in 2002 to 8% in 2006, and they swung from 40% Republican to 30% Republican. Huge shift, enormous consequences for 2008. So this is something we've been very involved in. It's been very gratifying, and so that's the kind of stuff we work on.
So in the midst of this, we find Republicans and conservatives in general demonizing in particular, people of brown skin. I mean, you know, right across the board, whether they're Muslim or, I mean, it used to be just African Americans were bearing the brunt of this. And now, I mean, you know, from, oh, my God, they've got leprosy to,
everything.
You know, it's, the whole thing. And the racists are coming out of the closet and being applauded and patted on the back and whatnot.
I agree.
And I'm just curious to what extent do you think that the caging efforts and all of the other efforts that the Republican Party have engaged in the last two presidential election cycles, in the last four election cycles in general, the obvious caging in Florida, the obvious caging in Ohio, those two states in all probability, in fact, I think with a virtual certainty, were won by Kerry and Gore, respectively, big reverse order. And now, just now, finally, members of Congress are using the word caging. This huge voter disenfranchisement machine that Karl Rove has built out of the White House that is really at the core of this whole attorney scandal, even though nobody in the media will discuss it.
Right.
Is that machine going to be used in the 2008 election against Hispanics? And if so, how? And if so, how do we stop it?
It's a great... I hadn't really thought about it just in the way that you're saying. You know, traditionally, the Republicans never spent money on voter turnout in Hispanic communities because what they spent their money on was persuasion, and they allowed us to bring all the Republicans to the polls, which was a smart strategy. Yeah, thank you for that. I was coming in a little weak on the mic. But I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think it would be easy. I mean, what I think we should expect if the immigration bill particularly is not resolved this year and this immigration debate stays with us through the fall of next year, I guess what we should expect is a massive set of very strategic challenges of Hispanic citizens questioning their citizenship there, whether they're illegal or illegal.
Yeah. You look like you might speak Spanish. Go back home and get your driver's license and two other forms of ID.
Right, that kind of stuff. I think that we should anticipate that, particularly if the immigration bill doesn't get passed. If the immigration bill gets passed this year and a good bill is signed into law,
they'll still do it because this is a 6 to 8 year process.
Yeah, they will, but I think it becomes harder. It becomes harder. I think the suspicion of the American people will be greater. Because, look, one of the things they've done, and I've followed this stuff, and I appreciate you bringing this up because I think this has been very... you know, when I ran for chair for the party 2 years ago against Howard Dean, and one of the lines that I used in every debate was, I don't know how it's possible that there's one party in America that wants everybody to vote and another party that doesn't want anybody to vote, and that we haven't been able to accrue brand significance for us. How have we not been able to take political advantage of that, given that, you know, we should be making it very clear to the American people in simple, plain English that we want everybody to vote and they don't, right? It's a simple message. And I think this is, I agree with you. We have dramatically underexploited this.
But they have been incredibly successful. I mean, the fact of the matter is only 32 or maybe 33 or 34, it's under 35 cases of actual voter fraud been uncovered in the United States.
It's
one
a joke.
Of them was Ann Coulter.
No, it's
right?
a joke. It's,
I mean, you know, people who registered in the wrong place or shouldn't have voted.
It's manufactured. It's an absurd. I mean, here
and
we
yet
have,
most Americans perceive there to be a problem of voter fraud when, in fact, there's a problem of election fraud.
Agreed. But the problem is that's our fault. I mean, I would argue that.
I'd say it's the media's fault.
No, I think it's we haven't prosecuted the case properly. We've got a very strong argument to make. I think it's I think in part because in our family, this stuff is sort of left to the lawyers, right? And the political people haven't gotten
involved. I had a conversation with one of the advisors to the Kerry campaign.
Yeah.
I don't want to out this guy. But a senior operative in the Democratic Party, this is about a year ago, and who acknowledged to me that there was a good probability that Kerry actually took Ohio.
Yeah.
And there was a very high probability that in those 6 or 8 or 12 states, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, where there's significant red shift, particularly with the machines, that machines were actually rigged. And went on to say the Democratic Party will not discuss this. And the reason they will not discuss this is because they are certain. The Democratic Party really, these guys really and truly believe that if election fraud and caging and rigged voting machines and all this stuff is talked about by the Democrats, that the Republicans will characterize us as believers in UFOs, and it will harm the Democratic Party.
I mean, I've been talking about this for years. I agree with you on this. Is that, you know, again, I think there's a very...
How do we convince the Democrats?
But I think this is... here's
they're being ripped off.
Well, but let's make it very simple, right? Which is, this is there's a lot of folks running through here. Is that my advice to you when you get your guests on to sort of make your case for this is that there's a simple message. We want everybody to vote. They don't, right?
Yeah.
That is the frame for this conversation, and that's something that people can understand. My wife can understand it. My father can understand it, right? It's not a complicated
But then you get the right-wing talk show hosts who say, yeah, they want everybody to vote, including all those people who are here illegally, and they just want to vote for welfare benefits for themselves.
That's not true. We can win that argument, right? We can win that argument. I mean, look.
Not if our voice isn't heard.
Agreed. And I agree with you that this is an area that we have left on the table, and we need your help in putting this on the table in the next couple of weeks.
It's on the table on this show on a real regular basis. So.
Thanks, Tom.
Simon Rosenberg, the NDN, president of NDN. Website, Simon?
NDN.org. Simple.
That works.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the opportunity.
16 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Stand much longer. We're going to take back America. That's what we're doing here at the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Tom Hartman here with you, and Susie Turnbull is with us. She is the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee,
yep.
The DNC.
And yes, absolutely, Tom, and I'm happy to be here, and I'm proud to be a Democrat.
There you go. And it's so funny, when you sat down, I said, you're still the vice chair of the RNC, and you what? And it's because I had the RNC email up in front of me.
And probably turned green.
Yeah.
Like, what?
What?
All these years, all this work. For what?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You're a good sport. Susie, what's happening with the DNC these days?
Well, we're really proud. We're preparing. We get to go around the country right now and go, we won. We're still excited about 2006, as you can imagine, but we're building for 2008. What we did in 2006 was put organizers on the ground early, 18 months early, and our organizers are still all over the country. And what we're doing is building a party. We're building a place where whether you're running for county council or Congress, we're paying attention to you, and that's the reason why we have a majority of Democratic governors right now, and that we have took over 13 legislative chambers in 2006. What we do is we support whoever is our nominee, and we are spending a lot of time and a lot of energy right now making sure that the people know about the Republican potential nominees.
Sure.
As well.
Susie, two issues that I'd like to discuss with you as one of the two senior officials in the entire party here. First is that for the first time, members of Congress are talking about caging. We know that in the 2000 election, Al Gore, I mean, the BBC did this report. Al Gore actually won Florida, or would have won Florida, if 70, 80, 90,000 African Americans hadn't been caged, hadn't been knocked off the voting rolls. There's considerable evidence the same thing happened in Ohio to John Kerry, and that, in fact, we won both those elections. I would say unequivocally, but, you know, it's up for debate. You're nodding your head. First of all, your thoughts on what I just said.
I think that what we've done, and I think in 2006, what we did in Ohio is probably the best indication of how seriously we take what's going on with the voter integrity. And after the 2004 election, I traveled across the country, and no matter where I went, I heard people say, well, what difference does it make if my vote doesn't count anyway? Yeah. And if I'm going to be knocked off the ballot, and we can't trust the machines, and
right.
We can't do this stuff.
And people feel that way because John Kerry, you know, conceded so quickly in 2004. I mean, up in Washington State, next to where I live, Dino Rossi, as I recall, Christine Gregoire, I mean,
it was six months
you had this Republican whining and complaining and yelling and screaming and making a huge stink. And frankly, it energized the Republican Party in Washington State, and it did make voting fraud an issue. And why has the Democratic Party been so afraid to touch it up till now?
I don't don't think we're really afraid to touch it. I mean, I think the Christine Jennings from Florida is still hanging out there, basically, because
the Republican opponent. I mean, 18,000 missing votes, and yet you guys control the House of Representatives. You control the parliamentary process. You've installed her opponent. Why?
I think that in that case, it's still be in front of the courts and it will take time, but I think it's still an open question. But what we are saying is we are given, and what we did in 2006 is we give states the opportunity to make sure that we have lawyers on the ground, we have lawyers before the election, so that the kinds of things that Ken Blackwell did in Ohio, the weight of a paper to submit an absentee ballot, that things like that don't happen. And they didn't happen in Ohio, and what we can use our experience in 2006 as a model for the future. I know that Russ Holt and has a bill that's pending. We are looking at all sorts of things.
But his bill is so full of holes, it's like Swiss cheese. I mean, why, if the whole purpose of government is to control the commons that we collectively own, why would we take the most important part of government, the beating heart of government, which is the vote, and hand that over to private corporations? That seems to me like the most insane thing to privatize, and yet 80% of Americans are going to be voting on machines that are owned and programmed by private corporations. This is crazy.
And and one of the things you're hearing here at the conference, too, is that all of the outsourcing, not only for that, a lot of those services of government that are outsourced.
No, the military, the post office, I mean, it goes on.
But the vote
is at the core.
But the vote is at the core.
Quick question. We only have about 20 seconds left. I'm sorry, 30 seconds left. The Democrats voted to give Bush his money. I'm hearing from all my people that they're going to pay a terrible price for this. What's the Democratic Party going to do to fix this?
I think that what you're seeing the Democratic Party did is that we sent our members of Congress who voted for this out into their districts to talk to their districts, to talk to their constituents about what the decisions were based on. And one of the things that they did do is that they did set up some benchmarks. They did say that we are going to look at this, we're going to be closer, and we're going to make sure that when comes September, things may be very,
things
very different.
Things are going to change. Good. Susie Turnbull, you're doing a great job, and you and Howard Dean, I you really are, and I'm really glad that you're there.
Thanks so much, Tom.
For being
with
us today. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, right here on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Taking back America one person at a time, one vote at a time, one mind at a time. Carl Agnew is with us. He's the founding partner of Gersten Agnew, providing strategy, message, and research services to a variety of corporate, political, and nonprofit clients. GerstenAgnew.com, the website. And you're speaking here at the conference about how culture and new media can move progressive ideas. You are one of those guys who advises politicians on how to behave?
I am, in certain ways, yes.
What's your advice these days?
My advice, more than anything, is listening to the people and staying focused on the message out there and the political environment in which we're operating. I think, particularly with the new Congress, people have lost sight exactly of the change that they were elected and brought in here to enact. They've gotten caught up a little too much in the Beltway and in the debate here, and it's a difficult and dangerous environment here, and they need to stay focused on the election results of 2006, why they were elected, and why they're here in the first place.
Do you agree with me that the Democrats just horribly blew it when they voted for the Iraq funding?
They were in a difficult position. What I found in going out and doing focus groups and talking to people is that the president had a very strong position in that the clock was going to run out, and in many ways people were concerned that something was going to happen. The troops were in some way going to be put in danger. That, I believe, was ultimately not true, but there was a public perception out there. The Democrats certainly could have held Bush's feet to the fire a lot longer. They could have shaped the political debate in a very difficult way. They saw that the end game was potentially going to work against them, and they just kind of ducked out a lot earlier than they needed to.
I think it was a disaster.
Yeah.
It was stupid.
It was a game of chicken, and they pulled off about a half mile before they were going to collide.
Right, yeah. And as a result, you know, everywhere I go, people are talk to people, and they're like, you know, the Democrats funded this war. The Democrats decided to make the war last another year. I mean, it's like Bush and the Republicans just walked away with this thing. I mean, you know, none of that tar stuck to them. I'm just astounded.
But Bush owns this war. I mean, there's no question about that in the popular mind.
Not anymore. Not anymore. I'm telling you, not anymore. The Democrats own this war now. That vote totally screwed the Democratic Party. It totally screwed most of the Democratic candidates who did it. There's going to be hell to pay for it. And I don't think the Democratic Party has even begun to understand the damage that vote did. They have lost credibility. I mean, you lose people's trust, you don't get it back real quick. And, you know, some little song and dance in September ain't going to work.
I think that's the problem. They were thinking that we'll get another shot at this in 3 months, so we'll just punt it down the road. And I think that was very short-sighted.
Well, then they should have given them a 3-month funding.
Yep.
You know, this is just I can't tell you how tragic. I mean, you know, how just I don't know, disgusted. What are the issues, Carl? We're talking with Carl Agnew. He's a founding partner at Gerson Agnew, a consulting firm that, among other things, consults with politicians, Democratic politicians, here in Washington, D.C. First of all, how do you start a consulting firm that consults with politicians?
Well, I've been working in the industry for over a decade now, and worked with some of the biggest firms in the country, and was fortunate to gain access to a lot of folks and a lot of experiences here at a young age. And so when I moved out on my own, I had those existing relationships and was able to use those to build one candidate and one elected official at a time. It's really about relationships.
I saw Bob Schrum in your bio. Bob Schrum has lost 8 out of 8 elections. Yep. The guy's a total putz. Why would you want to do business with him?
Well, I didn't go into business with him. I started a nonprofit organization. He was one of the founders of it. I was the executive director. But
I mean, he argues the good argument on TV. God bless him.
Yes, he does.
You know, he's clearly a very nice guy. But I mean, come on.
Bob's exceptionally talented. He elected a lot of people to Congress. He did a lot of good at a lot of levels, and he lost a lot of bad races. And I think, by his own admittance, made some big mistakes in the biggest moments. I don't fall for the caricature of him. I know him personally, and I know that he is a committed progressive, and he believes in things, and he made mistakes. And I've lost races.
Why doesn't he fight for those commitments if he really has them?
In what way?
Well, for example, Kerry fighting back against the Swift Boat veterans.
Yeah.
For example, Dukakis being characterized as the whole Willie Horton thing, when in fact it was a Republican governor who preceded him who signed into law the legislation that allowed Willie Horton to get out of office or out of prison, and it was Dukakis who reversed that. I mean, there was not only not an issue there, it was a lie.
Oh,
and Schrum's advice to Dukakis, is, at least as I've heard, is don't respond to it, stay away from it. That sounds to me like insanity.
It was very poor advice. There's no question about it. And I can't vouch for the specific decisions that he made during those races. What I can say is that in the heat of these races, it's very difficult. You got a lot of voices. There are good arguments on both sides. Yeah. They made the wrong choice.
And here I am bitching about the past. I mean, you know, let's get on to the present. What are the issues? What are the big frames that, in your opinion, are either strongest for the Democrats or represent the greatest Republican vulnerabilities going into the 2008 election, both at the presidential level and in the House and Senate races all over the country, because every single member of the House is up for re-election, and a third of our senators are up for re-election.
It's impossible to overstate how much Iraq dominates this political environment and dominates everything about it. There are other issues. There are other issues that matter, and people are certainly voting on other issues, but it's such the driving force of the skepticism and the negativity in this political environment right now, and it raises the bar for everyone to have to speak to voters. To be
in that
heard.
Case, we're talking with Carl Agnew, founding partner of Gerson Agnew, GersteinAgnew.com, the website. Let me play out a scenario for you.
Absolutely.
Right after the Democrats voted to give George his money for another year, you had Mitch Daniels come out and say, we're going to start pulling down the troops this fall. By spring, they're going to be significantly reduced levels. A Republican leader in the Senate. You had, I'm forgetting which one it was now, but it was one of the top three You had one of the top three Republican leaders in the House. And I wish I had the notes in front of me so I could give you his name. But anyhow, he was on TV saying, we shouldn't call this a war anymore. We should call it an occupation. Now, you know, 3 years ago or 2.5 years ago, I wrote a piece for Common Dreams that, you know, 6 months later, then other pieces started appearing from other people saying essentially the same thing, arguing that as long as we call this a war, there, that frame, you win a lot of wars or you lose wars, and that frame is a stupid frame because the war actually ended when George Bush stood up on that aircraft carrier. I mean, he was right.
Mission accomplished.
The war actually, you know, you end a war when you take down another country, you take down their government, you seize their institutions. We did all that. We won the war. What began then was the occupation. Now, occupations are not won or lost. Occupations are finished or not. Mm-hmm. And so when I heard the literally the, you know, within 3 hours of the signing of that bill, when I heard two major Republicans start talking about drawing down troops in the fall and spring and talking about it's an occupation, not a war, what clicked for me is that the Bush administration is going to start drawing the troops down. They're going to claim victory for the surge in September. They've already set it up. Petraeus has already got the talking points out there. No matter what happens, they think they control reality, and to a large extent they do. They will claim that they won. They'll start drawing down the troops in the fall. By the spring, we'll be down to half the troop levels we are right now. Since the press does not go out of the green zone, if there's chaos in other areas, we won't even know about it. And to the extent that it happens, as long as it's not killing American soldiers, by and large, Americans won't care about it. I mean, look at what's going on in Afghanistan right now. Most Americans don't even know about that. They, you know, so what happens if by July, August, September of 2008, the broad American public perception is Bush won the war because the occupation is over? We're down. Our military has been redeployed just to the bases, the 17 bases that we've built, and into the green zone. U.S. deaths are down to like one or two a week. The Iraqi government is standing up. Yes, it may be far worse than Saddam Hussein was on his best days, but, or his worst days, however you want to characterize it. But nonetheless, if the signature issue that you guys are counting on to win in 2008 is the war, I'm predicting that the Republicans are going to pull that rug out from underneath you. If they do, what do you do?
I don't think they can. I think it's impossible for them to claim victory. Too much has gone under. What you have to understand is that in the minds of most Americans, they've put Bush in a box. They're done with this presidency.
But Bush isn't running for re-election.
Right. But my point is that they've put him there. They're not really listening to much of what he says. These Republicans have a clear voting record over several years on this war. They've got a clear record of statements on this war. They can't run away from the past.
Right. So if there's a perception that they were successful, hey, we won. No more fighting. Stable government, schools are coming back online. Yeah, they're madrasas. Women are walking down the streets again. Yes, they're wearing burqas, but you know, nonetheless, it's stable now. Just like Afghanistan, most Americans think that we've essentially won in Afghanistan. You know, Afghanistan, 80% of Afghanistan by population is controlled by the Taliban and the warlords. You know, over 95% of the geographic area, and yet the perception is we've won it.
I don't think the perception is entirely. The perception, much as you painted with Iraq, is that we won the initial effort and that we're losing ground now. There's certainly a lot more dire reality to it than that, but people at least understand the broad contours of it.
I don't think Joe Sixpack does. I think the primary voters may. Attending to politics.
Well, we've seen it in our surveys and in our focus groups, you know, where we are talking to independents, you know, undecided voters out there, is that there is that general sense coming through. But there's also a general sense that we can't win in Iraq. The majority of Americans don't believe there is such a thing as victory in Iraq anymore. There's only getting out.
Right, but getting out is you know, you wipe your brow and say, okay, that's over.
But I don't think it's going to be perceived as a victory.
When Eisenhower finally wrapped up, Eisenhower ran on the campaign of going to resolve the Korean War.
Yep.
Vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace was his campaign slogan. He did. He was enormously popular because of it. If Bush can resolve this, I think he'll be enormously popular.
I don't think so, because I think he owns the failure. He owns the failure.
I hope you're right and I'm wrong. I really and truly do.
I believe so.
Okay. Carl Agni. GerstinAgni.com, the website. Carl, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
I get around, yeah, get around, round, round. I get around, I get around.
Down the same
Yeah, we're getting bugged by this same old administration. The same old 26 years of right-wing cranks running this country. Time to change it. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from the Take Back America conference in Washington, D.C. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Christina Wilfer is with me. Am I saying that right?
Yep, exactly.
Great. And Christina is the executive director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. The website is ballot.org. And by ballot initiatives, you're talking about those states that have what used to be referred to as direct democracy, mm-hmm. or in a way. It's
Yes.
So elaborate a little bit.
Well, there's 24 states that allow citizens to directly petition to change laws. And those laws range from anything like we saw certainly last year with minimum wage to renewable energy to a lot of conservative right-wing gimmicks. So we see the whole gamut of issues that ultimately get to the ballot. But every state actually can refer something. A state legislature can refer something to the ballot. So even in the non-initiative states, there's a lot of ballot activity increasingly, actually. And then there's also in the non-initiative states and initiative states, local propositions. So somebody may vote on something in Madison, Wisconsin, even though that they don't have the statewide process.
Right. So your organization does what with regard to this?
We are a think and do tank, as I like to say, for ballot uh-huh. measure activity.
Right.
So we really exist to put together a progressive strategy for how do we take issues that, for whatever reason, aren't happening at the federal level. Some of these things are happening at the state level, but how do we push progressive policies out through the ballot measure process? And how do we actually have a conversation with voters about what our values are, what our issues are, what it means to be a progressive? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, appeal to certain voters who may not be participating. So initiatives do have the opportunity to turn out certain voters who otherwise might just sit at home.
Well, and I think that's the key. In the state where I live, in Oregon, over the last, in particular, I'd say the last 6, 8, 10 years, I've only lived there for 2 years, but, you know, reading the history and talking with people who've lived there, there are two, arguably three, but two very high-profile guys who everybody recognizes their names.
Bill Sizemore.
Yeah, he's one of them, yeah. Who get money from folks like Mr. Rich, the real estate developer in, is it Chicago or New York? I forget which.
New York.
And New York. And Lauren Parks, who's the sexual hypnotist who lives in Las Vegas. That's what he calls himself,
yep.
A sexual hypnotist. And they're very wealthy guys. And they put ballot initiatives on sometimes actually ones that actually even make a little sense, you know, like not allowing insurance companies to change your ratings based on your credit scores, and which was one of the ones that Bill Sizemore did last time.
Mm-hmm.
And here I found myself on the radio recommending people to vote against a ballot initiative that I thought was a good thing, because I knew that he was doing it so that he could have a successful ballot initiative, so he could go back to his funders and say, see, I still have the mojo. I can get a ballot initiative passed. Give me another couple $100,000, because this is how these guys make their living.
Mm-hmm.
This is how they pay their mortgage. And you know, maybe they're making such a good living they no longer have mortgages. But anyhow, this is how they're making their living. And I don't see the same thing happening on the progressive side. Dan Meek, a local attorney in Portland, got very, very hard, got two ballot initiatives on. They didn't, one passed, the other one didn't. But, you know, nothing like this. Nothing like this. Is our experience in Oregon characteristic of national trends?
Absolutely. Oregon is just, you get an indication.
We're one of the test states, aren't we?
Exactly. So what happens in Oregon often is the canary in the mine,
yeah.
of what may actually roll out with bad ballot measures that we end up fighting. And what we're trying to do, though, is change that landscape, and so that we're not always in this defensive posture. Unfortunately, we're always going to have a handful of initiative activists who take gimmicky right-wing policies, often targeted at trying to take down the power of unions or trying to undermine workers or trying to roll back reproductive choice rights. Or gay rights. Everything that was about the ban on gay marriage was a sort of fake issue, if you will, in that it was already illegal in all of those states. And they've got some big check writers on their side. They make an industry of it and a business of it, and that's just the reality of the initiative process. The challenge for us is how to stop those gimmicks, which we actually did very successfully in 2006. The Howie Rich strategy that was not only this Tabor taxpayer bill of rights,
right.
but takings and the anti-court measures. Overall, he tried to attempt those issues in 35 states. You know how many states they won?
No.
One.
Wow.
One. And he spent about, from what we can calculate, a lot of this is hidden, around $16 million through Americans for Limited Government and the various subsidiary organizations where they were trying to hide money and get these on the ballot through dirty tricks and dirty activity, illegal actually, that got them kicked off the ballot in several states. So we really proved in 2006 that we can deal with those dynamics of our opponents that we have at the ballot almost every year. But at the same time, we have to offer our own ideas. And so we may not have the Howie Riches of the world, but we have a grassroots base of activists who are using initiatives strategically, minimum wage being the biggest example of that in 2006.
So are you aggregating funds to be the left-wing Howie Rich? Are you out there helping people in various states who are trying to do ballot initiatives, or are you simply advising them on how?
We from soup to nuts, we help think of ideas, help organizations research those ideas, poll them, figure out what is going to be popular and how to run campaigns. We train staff, dispatch staff to campaigns, and help them bundle money and raise money and have a national conversation around how we use this as a strategic tool.
That's absolutely great. I hope you're talking to Dan Meek in Portland.
Yes.
He's a good guy and he's doing great work. Christina Wilfor is the executive director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. The website is ballot.org. We just have a couple of seconds left. What do you think is going to be the top issue that's going to be on the ballot in 2008? Right or left wing?
I think we're going to see a lot of activity around Iraq. That their measures, whether they're non-binding or resolutions or whether they deal with benefits issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think Iraq is going to be big. I think there's payday loan and predatory lending reform
right.
are also getting a lot of energy in healthcare.
Yeah. That sounds like a reasonable list.
Mm-hmm.
Christina, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Christina Wilford, Executive Director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, ballot.org.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., the Center for America's Future. Holly Sklar is here with me, author, thinker, pundit. Lobby? Not really a lobbyist. Activist. Advocate. I'm sorry. Say it again.
Advocate for good policies.
There you go.
There you go.
Holly Sklar with us, and just a quick thumbnail of some of the things that you've been writing and what you have out right now.
Yeah, we did a good report, A Just Minimum Wage, Good mm-hmm. for Workers, Business, and Our Future. Did a book called Raise the Floor: Wages and Policies That Work for All of Us. I've been working a lot on minimum wage, the importance of raising the floor under all workers, and how important that is for the economy in general. And, you know, in 2006, there were great victories raising the minimum wage, 6 out of 6 states, then went on to have the federal minimum wage go higher, but not high enough. You know, getting to $7.25 by 2009 was the least you could do under really conservative conditions. But we have to go a lot further and a lot faster because workers have lost so much ground. Minimum wage was the highest way back in 1968 in terms of buying power.
Yeah.
In terms of buying power.
And it's nothing close to that now.
Nothing close to that. Matter of fact, to have the minimum wage today, you know, with the buying power that it had in 1968, you'd have to be over $9.50, not $5.15. That's just crazy.
Yeah.
And it's really hurt. It's hurt the economy. It's hurt local communities. It's hurt local businesses because what I always try and say is, look, every time when you raise the minimum wage, people don't take the money and put it under their mattress. They don't take the money and put it in a, you know, in an offshore tax haven. They take that money and it goes recycled right back into the local economy, into neighborhood stores.
It's stimulative.
It's a real stimulus versus a bogus stimulus.
Now, I just find it amazing that so many Americans have bought the belief that is put out there by the conservatives that when people do get an increase in their minimum wage, that the consequence will be the same as a tax cut for billionaires. That is, that, you know, it'll end up in an offshore tax haven. I mean, they don't come out and say that, but they just, like, they, you know, I don't think that the average person even thinks about that recycling effect. In part, of course, that's because of the deception and the spin and all that stuff that the conservatives are. But I'd say a large part of that is because we haven't been saying it. You know, we haven't been, and the mainstream media never talks about these issues.
No, and that's one of the reasons we've been working with a lot of business people. Mm-hmm. A lot of business people who understand that the raising the minimum wage, raising the average wages, is good for business. Not just good for workers, and, oh, it's a nice thing to do because workers really need the money, which they do, which they do. I mean, it's just crazy. You've got a minimum wage in which people are constantly saying, okay, is it going to be health care or rent? Is it
right.
going to be food or childcare? You know, I mean, we're talking about basic necessities, people constantly choosing between them. But there are a lot of business people, and this is one of the reasons why it won in 6 out of 6 states and why it finally passed. You know, we just came off, when it goes up on July 24th, the first raise in the minimum wage in nearly 11 years. That's
right.
how long it's taken. It's insane. And one of the reasons it finally won is because people all over the country were organizing about it and mad about it, but also because there were business people who were saying, this is hurting us. This is not good for the economy. I'm feeling it. If my customers don't have enough money, you know,
to buy my products,
I'm going to feel it in my store.
Yeah, the fact that
right?
I can pay my 3 employees less doesn't help my 5,000 customers
that's
who come
exactly
to the store this
right.
year.
And people seem to not get that,
yeah.
not get that at all. You're going to
yeah.
get much back in terms of that. And it's local economy. That's the thing. The states that have actually raised their minimum wage above the federal level, got tons of research on this. Those states have had better employment trends, better business trends.
Now, here's the problem
yeah.
with all this. I mean, the where this blows up on us, on you and me.
Yeah.
And that is that if people get an increase in their minimum wage and they use that money to buy more food at McDonald's and more stuff from Walmart, every single night at midnight a button gets pushed and all of that local money goes like that giant vacuum cleaner and ends up in a bank in Chicago or in a bank in Little Rock, and it doesn't get recycled in the local economy. Don't we need to combine increasing minimum wages with strengthening laws that allow local communities to determine their local economic destinies, things like rolling back corporate personhood, not allowing corporations to claim the 14th Amendment right against non-discrimination to come into communities and force themselves into communities, to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act and break up some of these huge corporations? I mean, isn't this all of one fabric?
It's all of one fabric, but of course you can't go for the whole. You can't do it all at once. Why not? You can. That's your job.
Yeah.
You're
going to
do it all at once.
You bet.
But you take the pieces you can achieve, right?
Yeah.
And
okay,
so everybody works on different things as a priority. But there, it's increasingly clear that this that there's a, basically there are some corporations, many, that are not invested in this country. They don't care what happens to the community. They're not invested in the country in the sense of caring for the long haul, what's going to happen to the economy and the economic future of our country, the future of our people, whatever. They've got their eyes on, you know, the prize in the next month, how many stock options the CEO is going to get. They're essentially milking the country like a cash cow, right? Milking the country like a cash cow. And you have other business people who we want to work with very much who understand that they're rooted in the community, they're rooted in the future of the country. They're not about milking it like a cash cow. They're about helping grow for the future.
But that latter category is shrinking.
That latter category, well,
I mean, you and I are probably old enough, I think I'm far older than you, but nonetheless, we're probably both old enough to remember a time when the average strip mall was at least 75-80% locally owned stores, mom-and-pop stores, in any city in America. And today, they're almost 100% chain stores.
Well, that's one of the reasons why this is a kind of a tipping point where businesses also have to be really fighting back. Now, I happen to live in a neighborhood in Boston where it's 70% independent business.
Yeah,
and one of the reasons for that is because the not just kind of activists in general are saying we don't want, you know, only chains, but because the business district is organized. And so you have the essentially the customers and the business people all invested in the community and knowing they want a different vision of this community than another strip mall kind
yeah.
of community. And so that's one thing that I think has to happen much more. The people who are on the ground doing terrific community organizing in low-income neighborhoods and working-class neighborhoods and middle-class neighborhoods, you know, more mixed neighborhoods, have to see it, like you're saying, in this more kind of a more whole vision, right? And say, those of us who are invested in the future of this community in a real way, in the strength of it for the long term, have to figure out how to work together and work on what is good for this local community, local economy. And there are success stories around the country like that.
Yeah.
And the business people, one of the things we're concerned with, because we think we're going to be able to win more with business who do believe in these policies on our side, rather than, not that they're not on our side, but they're often quiet. You don't hear them on talk radio enough. You hear the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, right, for example.
Sure.
But you don't hear the Women's Chamber of Commerce. It happens that the U.S. Women's Chamber of Commerce is supportive of many good policies.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Business and Women and Professional Association, or the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, the American Independent Business Association. There are a whole bunch of associations now that we need to be hearing from a lot more, working with us, who aren't working against us. But their voices essentially are too drowned out.
Right. We're talking with author and activist Holly Sklar, who's always churning out some new commentary or activity that boggles my mind. Holly, where do we go from here? What do we do? I mean, how, let me make that much more specific. How do we integrate all this activist activity, all this independent activity, all these different organizations? You've just gone through a whole laundry list of them. They're out there doing great work. How do we get them and the Democratic Party together in the same room? There are so many conservative Democrats. There are so many of the DLC Democrats. There are so many Democrats who frankly would have nothing to do with anybody on that list that you just named. Obviously, all of the Republicans fit into that category. Maybe Susan Collins not, but virtually all the Republicans. How do we take back the Democratic Party and involve that and make it a more progressive organization?
Well, one thing is that people need to keep pushing for what they really believe in and not settling at this point, and not saying, well, you know, I'm going to be more quiet about what I really mean by universal health care, for example, in order to make it, as some people might say, well, you know, if you really want to have some kind of health care reform, don't talk about universal health care in a more true sense, but rather let's do it piecemeal and let's, you know, it's going
to
take forever.
In other words, we the people have to start kicking the butts of the politicians.
We the people have to stand up for what we really want and continue to say what we really want all the way through, from today all the way through when this election takes place and then after. And that is to say, it's not just about your rhetoric when you're running. It's about your rhetoric. That is, you have to push much harder now for better policies by the candidates who are running. Push much harder on the Congress, right, that's in office now.
Sure.
There's plenty they can't do because the Republican, you need 60 votes in the Senate to close debate, and so a simple majority doesn't do it. We know that.
Yeah.
You can still be standing up and you know, okay, if the president's going to veto it, the president's going to veto it. If it's
you give it to him again.
But we're at a tipping point on climate change, on the economy, on health care, where things can go in a really good direction. But the only reason they're going to, because so many people understand how broken things are in all those areas.
Holly Sklar, right. Thanks.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Pick us all up here. We got to get going. We got to take back this country. Taking Back America. It's the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Tom Hartman broadcasting live 21 minutes past the hour. And one of my heroes is sitting right across from me, Medea Benjamin. Hey. Oop, let me turn your microphone on.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, great to have you with us here. You were out singing at Code Pink. Right? Code Pink, and you were out singing, and you're doing street theater and guerrilla theater that you do so well. And even doing it here, and I know you even managed to irritate a couple of my colleagues, and I'm saying to them, you know, trying to stop Code Pink is like trying to stop the Columbia River. This is a force of nature. You don't mess with these women. You just don't do it.
We told them the war irritates us.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Somebody said, Medea, you're irritating us. Yeah, right. So Joe Lieberman, tell me what happened.
He irritates us. You know, it's bad enough we have one war going, Tom, but then when you hear somebody like Joe Lieberman on CBS Face the Nation talking about how the Iranians are equipping and training Iraqis to go in and kill U.S. soldiers, and of course he talks about them being a nuclear threat when the experts say that they're a decade away from being really a nuclear threat, and he talks about that a real option is to go ahead and bomb them. So we were appalled by that. In fact, We just had a delegation return from Iran in one of these citizen diplomacy delegations, and one of the women on there said, I'm going first thing Monday morning into Joe Lieberman's office. I'm going to stop eating. I'm going to do a fast in his office and demand a meeting with him.
Mm-hmm. And?
Well, we did get a meeting with him. We were told to come back on Thursday, 4:30 p.m. We brought a group of our supporters. In fact, about 60 of us showed up in his office.
Mm-hmm.
We get there, and the staff tells us, the senator is not going to meet with you. And we were pretty angry about that.
Wait a minute. Joe Lieberman had said he would meet with you,
right.
And then when you showed up, he said, change my mind.
Yeah, they said, no, you didn't really want to meet. You wanted to do a sit-in in our office. And we said, no. We did a sit-in to get the meeting. Once you gave us the meeting, we're here to meet. And they said, well, he's changed his mind. So it started getting pretty tense there. The woman who was doing the fast started to cry. She brought out pictures of all these kids and saying, you know, these are the kids that would die if he
Iranian
went ahead and bombed. All of these beautiful Iranian kids. And Iranian women started to join her and start crying. And I think then the staff got a little embarrassed because there were cameras rolling. And so, because they called the police. And the police came in and the police gave us a warning and said, everybody out of here, you'll be arrested. And finally the staff backed down and said, all right, you can meet with the chief of staff and the head of the legislative department and the person who works on the Middle East. So we had about an hour meeting with them while others waited outside.
Mm-hmm.
And we came out.
What was the essence of that meeting? If
the essence of the meeting was our side saying to the staff, look, there are now delicate talks going on between the U.S. and Iran. Those are very important. And what Joe Lieberman is doing now is, it seems to us, trying to derail those talks. The timing of his remarks are very suspicious to us. That this, if he thinks he's doing something good for Israel, this is about the worst thing that he could possibly do.
You know, that's what you read the blogs, and people say, oh, he's just doing this because, you know, he's Jewish or it's on behalf of AIPAC or Israel or whatever. And I don't buy it. I don't buy it because I don't think that Israel is that dumb. You know, there are a few hawks in Israel, of course, but the Olmert government, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I don't know, but Joe Lieberman sounds so insane when he's saying, I'm not talking about a ground invasion. I'm just talking about a couple of bombs here and there. Doesn't he understand what Iran would do to retaliate? And if he is saying that Iran is involved in killing of U.S. troops, which, you know, I find kind of strange because the U.S. has put in power a pro-Iranian government. But
right.
Even if it were true, doesn't he think that if we bombed Iran, they would attack U.S. troops big time in Iraq?
Well, not only that, Iran and Iraq have a mutual non-aggression pact. They have a mutual defense pact. I mean, they signed a treaty a couple of months ago that says that if either country is attacked, it's as if both countries were attacked. So if we attack Iran, Iraq has to go to their defense.
Well, that's right. It would be just you talk about a bloody civil war now, it would be just wild if the U.S. attacked Iran. So
why is Joe Lieberman doing this? I mean, is it Alzheimer's? Is it ill will? Is it political grandstand? He's not running for re-election. He's got a safe seat for 6 years. He's probably at that point going to retire from politics. I mean, what's the deal?
I mean, we say that it's not around Israel, although AIPAC was on the Hill not long ago lobbying for a more aggressive stance towards Iran. So who knows? In any case, we're back in his office today. We've contacted lots of Peace and Justice and Code Pink groups in Connecticut and say, stop this man. He's crazy. Stop him from talking like this.
Yeah, because it's actually harmful. We're talking with Medea Benjamin, what's your title with Code Pink?
Co-founder.
Co-founder. Yeah. Okay, that's a good one.
And if your listeners want to get involved in not only stopping Joe Lieberman, but all these other presidential candidates who are talking about no option is off the table, join us. You can go on the website, codepinkalert.org. You can email us at info@codepinkalert.org. And let's stop the next war before it starts.
Yeah. Would that we could have stopped the last one before it started. Amazing. CodePinkAlert.com and .org. CodePinkAlert.org. And real quickly, any other activities you got coming up?
Well, we are on the Hill every single day. We rented a 5-bedroom house here in Washington, D.C. We invite your listeners to come join us. You can apply online as well. And go with us to the hearings every day. Go with us into the offices and the halls of Congress. It's not enough to be opposed to the war. They got to hear us. They got to see us. They got to know we're serious about this.
There you go. Thank you. Medea Benjamin, CodePinkAlert.org, the website. Thanks so much for the great work
you're
doing.
Great. Thank you. And men are invited as well, Tom.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
can see the kind of damage that's been done by these right-wingers coast all over this nation. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on Air America Radio. It's we're at the Take Back America Conference, and Lawrence Korb... Oh, first of all, let me just mention our contest. Over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page is our blog. And if you participate in the blog today, David Poole, our producer, is going to pick what in his mind is the best entry, the best blog comment, and we'll give away a copy of my newest book, Screwed: The Undeclared War Against the American Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, to whoever posts what in David's totally capricious and arbitrary judgment is the best blog over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. So go over, say a few words. Lawrence J. Korb is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Prior to that, he was a senior fellow and director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. From July of 88 to October 2002, Council Vice President, Director of Studies, holder of the Maurice Greenberg Chair. And from 1981 to 1985, the Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, and ran about 70% of the Pentagon budget. That's a pile of money. Larry Korb, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. Author of over 20 books, 100 articles, most recently a new national security strategy in the age of terrorists, tyrants, and weapons of mass destruction, and reshaping America's military, four alternatives. I'm curious what your thoughts are on Joe Lieberman running around saying that we have proof now that Iran is arming people in Iraq who are killing Americans, and therefore we should start bombing them.
Well, I think that basically that's irresponsible, because if we were to bomb Iran, for example, we might be able to set back their nuclear program a little bit. We wouldn't get it all. But what they would do is they would cause all kinds more problems for us in Iraq. And we don't have the ground forces to follow up on a bombing to consolidate whatever gains we might make.
So what do we do?
Well, I think what you do...
Well, first of all, is the premise of what Lieberman's saying, is there any credibility to that, that Iran is interfering in the region? Because it seems to me that, you know, just looking at it from the outside, Iran has signed this mutual a defense treaty with Iraq, that they have diplomatic relations with Iraq, that they actually have a strong and powerful vested interest in seeing a stable Iraq. I mean, it's a Shia majority. Why not?
Well, there's no doubt about it. They're involved in Iraq. They've got about probably close to 40,000 people in there.
Well, they've opened a bank in Iraq, I mean,
of all things. That's correct. So they are involved. And the question really is, how do you make that involvement constructively? And you can't do that until you do two things. One, the United States has to set a date for withdrawal from Iraq. And the other thing is they have to pledge not to overthrow the Iranian regime. Once you do that, then I think you'll be able to work out a whole bunch of things with Iran, because Iran does not want an unstable Iraq. I mean, the worst fear, for example, in Iraq, that it would become like Afghanistan in the late 80s and early 90s after we withdrew, after the Soviets were chased out.
The Sunni Taliban.
And it would become, you know, an Al-Qaeda, a home for Al-Qaeda or another international terrorist group. Well, Iran doesn't want that either. I mean, Al-Qaeda is a Sunni group. They're Shias. Al-Qaeda is an Arabic group. They're Persians. And there's a lot of animosities there. So the last thing they would want is that.
So in a way, Lieberman is playing on the ignorance of the Americans. I don't, you know, because most Americans don't slice and dice at that level of detail.
Well, I mean, most Americans forget that in the only time Iran had a democracy, we overthrew it in the 50s,
yeah.
53.
Mossadegh.
Mossadegh, and basically put the Shah in power. And then the Shah was no day at the beach for the Iranians, and it laid the groundwork for Iranian's fundamentalist revolution. And we have not come to grips with that yet. So I think what we need to do is understand that Iran, by going into Iraq, the United States basically empowered Iran. Iran is more powerful than they were before we went in, because we removed a country that went to war with them for 8 years.
Sure.
So what you need to do is you need to work with Iran, as well as the other countries in the region, to come up with a strategy that balances America's strategic interests and theirs and ensures that it does not become a security or economic threat to us. And we have no other choice. I mean, just like, you know, Richard Nixon had to go to China to combat the Soviet Union, you're going to have to deal with all of the countries in the region to balance our interests there, and that includes Iran and Syria.
Yeah. Question I've long wanted to ask somebody who worked in the Defense Department during the Reagan administration. The Iran-Contra mess. The claim was made, the admission was made by the president, that there was an exchange that we were selling missiles and military parts to Iran in exchange for hostages. Yet at the time the sales began, there were no hostages anywhere in the world. And the most recent hostages had been the hostages that were confronting Jimmy Carter.
No, I think there were hostages that were taken at that time. And basically, we didn't give them to Iran. We actually, and this is ironic, we sold them to Israel. Israel sent missiles to Iran because we were prohibited by law from doing that. And
so
the idea was
the
that they did release hostages. It wasn't the hostages that were taken from the American embassy. These were Americans who were in that part of the world. And the Iranians did release a couple right in the beginning, but then what they did is they grabbed more. So in effect, they took advantage of us.
So the Iranians were holding American
hostages. Oh, yes, yeah, they were, yeah.
Before or at the time of the initiation?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, President Reagan admitted he made a mistake in what he said. He was very frustrated. Can't somebody do something to get these hostages out of there?
Right.
And then, of course, they had influence with the countries in the region. They had influence with the Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the hostages were actually grabbed in Lebanon.
Right.
Okay, and so that was the idea, that they would use their influence with Hezbollah, which was a creation of theirs, to release the hostages.
I'm curious about your personal journey from being in the Department of Defense in the Reagan administration to being one of the founders of the Center for American Progress, one of the most progressive think tanks in America.
Well, I think
we're talking about Lawrence Korb, by the way.
Yes, well, I think what has happened is, you know, the Republican Party has changed dramatically. I mean, when I first got attracted to the Republican, you had people like Eisenhower and Rockefeller. I mean, those were people that, you know, I liked, you know, Eisenhower. Remember, he said, beware of the military-industrial complex. And
I would argue that Eisenhower was a more progressive president than Bill Clinton.
Yeah, and even Nixon early on, you got to stop and think. He founded EPA, OSHA, subsidized Amtrak, had an affirmative action plan.
Although a lot of that came out of the Democratic Congress.
Well, they did, but he could have stopped it, just like Bush is, you know, stopping
point
things.
Taken.
And,
yeah.
And basically, in fact, Mark Shields, you know, who was the liberal commentator on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, says Nixon was our last liberal president.
Yeah.
Now, of course, then he, you know, because of his own insecurities and you got involved in Watergate, and that was terrible. But if you look, I mean, for example, he opened the door to China.
Yeah.
This is something that I think would be a good lesson today, where the Chinese were just coming out of the Cultural Revolution when Nixon and Kissinger went there. So, I mean, if we could deal with them then, why can't you deal with Iran or Syria? And, the Chinese were actually still helping the North Vietnamese at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So this, to me, that's the kind of, I would call that a progressive or realist policy. This administration is somebody called, you know, faith-based foreign policy, that somehow or another you can go in, change a regime with three men and a small boy and expect to transform the whole Middle East.
Right. And it's crazy. Your personal journey to this point in time?
Well, basically, I think that the Republican Party that I was happy to serve with has changed. Reagan made a mistake in Lebanon, right? He admitted it, and we got out, right?
Yeah.
Bush has made terrible mistakes, but rather than admitting them, he doubles down on the bets and keeps sending more and more Americans into
the
speak.
And the whole Republican Party goes along with him.
They do. I mean, the Republicans against them, Lincoln Chafee lost, but you got people like Susan Collins, but there are very few of them. We don't have the Jacob Javitses and the John Chafees and the people who I admired when I was growing up.
Yeah. For that matter, Barry Goldwater and Everett Dirksen. I mean, men of great integrity, even if you disagree with their policies. Your most recent book, A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We just have a minute left. What is your prescription?
Well, my prescription basically is that you've got to get back to fundamentals. Containment and deterrence still works. You've got to define your enemies. They're, you know, a group of violent extremists, and you're going to defeat them not with military means, primarily with non-military means, sharing intelligence, drying up their financial
assets. Spent $600 billion in Iraq. If we had taken that amount of money, which is probably, I can't do math that fast, but it's got to be $30,000, $40,000 per Iraqi citizen, and simply said, here, let us build you some schools and hospitals.
Well, there's no doubt that money could have been put to better use. And unfortunately, things in Iraq, I was just there in April, are no better for the Iraqi people than they were a couple of years ago. In fact, in many cases, though it's good to get rid of Saddam, their life is worse than it was for the average Iraqi.
It's the second worst failed state in the world, according
That's
to
correct.
The UN.
That's correct, yeah. There's no doubt about it. I mean, and before that, they were one of the more stable places in the Middle East.
Yeah. Amazing. Lawrence J. Korb, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, Senior Advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour, right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Well, at the end of 26 years of conservative right-wing crank rule in the United States, I'll tell you that, it is clearly happening. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., and our regular friend and guest on the program, and my favorite correspondent in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, is sitting right across the table from me.
Well, thank you.
It's
thank
so
you
nice
much.
To be live and in person with you.
It's fun, and that's one of my all-time favorite songs.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, one of the best.
Perfect. We picked it out just for you.
Picked it out just, of course you did.
it's one of those synchronicities, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Sometimes you just never know why it is that the universe does these things.
Way.
Yeah. This morning I heard Bill Richardson speak, and I heard Mike Gravel speak, and you heard Barack Obama and John Edwards.
Yeah, not the entire speeches, but part of the speeches.
Yeah, and first of all, my sense of Gravel and Richardson, they were both actually very good speeches, and very selective in what they were saying, things that were real, whip the crowds up. A lot of Bill Richardson's was about how he's going to save us from global warming and how he's already done it in New Mexico.
Really?
How the entire state of New Mexico is Kyoto compliant, and the first thing that he would do as president is sign the Kyoto Treaty, and he spent a lot of time on that, actually. So that was interesting. And
that's not an election winner.
Probably not, but it worked well for this base,
for this crowd.
Yeah. And Gravel was just thundering about how dare those Democrats send that Iraq funding legislation up. They should have shoved it down Bush's throat. They should have, just sent the same bill. Let him veto it. And he had the crowd on their feet.
I bet
people
he
were
did.
Screaming.
I bet he did.
He was like, these Democrats have wimped out. It's time to, it was incredible. So what happened with Edwards and Obama?
Obama was all over everything, including Iraq. He had them up. He had them down. He was really giving a stump speech. I mean, he was talking about himself. Mm-hmm. He talked about what I will do as president. There was a lot of that, and I would have preferred it more if he talked about the issues and less about what Obama would have done as president. But I understand that's his opportunity. This is the gig, and this is what he's here to do.
Sure.
But he was extremely effective with this crowd. And you recognize the charisma of the man.
Mm.
That frankly, he could have been saying something far less effective, and he would have still got a very big reaction from this crowd.
He's another Bill Clinton?
He doesn't quite have it. I mean, I've met Bill Clinton, and I would have taken my clothes off.
Yeah, I met Bill Clinton, and within 2 minutes, well, I'm not sure I would have done that, but within 2 minutes, I was convinced that he was convinced that I was his best friend.
Absolutely.
I mean, he has that ability to make you feel like you're the most important person in the entire world.
He is quite astonishing.
He really and truly is.
He really and truly is. Now, this guy, he's quite astonishingly good looking.
Barack Obama.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Quite amazingly good looking. And I think that helps him enormously.
Yeah.
And he does have charisma.
Now then, he was followed closely by Edwards, so that's always interesting if you want to be the first one or the second one.
Mm-hmm.
But Edwards is you know, no... He's good as a speaker, and in fact he's excellent as a speaker, and he's also incredibly good looking. He's better looking in person than I'm just doing a girl thing now.
That's fine.
He's better looking in person than he is on TV. He's tougher looking in person.
Yeah, he's a little more rugged, a little more of that Robert Redford.
Yeah, he's got more of that
as he's aging.
On.
He's
aging well.
Yeah.
And he just basically said, you know, I'm starting out with Iraq, and the crowd came to their feet and just went.
Yeah.
And he started off by saying, you know, about his vote, and I was wrong. Crowd erupted again. Yeah. And then he continued in that vein about Iraq, and he just went off.
Yeah. Last night, Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown and another senator whose name I'm losing, she's from Minnesota, were on a panel. And one of the people who asked a question asked Sherrod Brown, in 2006, as a member of the House, you voted for the Military Commissions Act. Why? And Sherrod Brown very simply said, that was a mistake. I was wrong. And he got a standing ovation.
That's right. You do when you admit a mistake.
Yeah, it was
That's
incredible.
That's what we like.
It was just incredible. And yet it's, you know, it has been for 30 years now, political conventional wisdom, you never admit you're wrong.
No, that's right. You just don't admit you're wrong. And a few of them are starting to learn it.
Yeah.
That you say it now, you say it fast,
yeah.
And you move on.
Yeah. Now, we have a very, very progressive audience here. I mean, this is the Take Back America conference. In your sense of it, was Barack Obama or John Edwards, was there a, of the two of them, since they were back-to-back and it was the same people in the same room at the same time for all practical purposes, was there a favorite, or did people just love them both, or was it?
If I was giving them, like, marks out of 100,
mm-hmm.
I would give Barack Obama 90, and I'd give 85 to Edwards.
Wow. So they were both really high, really,
really,
really
high.
Well,
yeah.
With Gravel and Richardson, my sense was that there were things that they said that people liked, but people were not going nuts like, I want this guy as my president.
See, that's the problem that Richardson's got. He says a lot of very interesting things. I went to his press conference, and he answered some questions very well.
See, I think he's running for vice president.
I think he is, too, and I think that could be what he gets.
Yeah. Well, in fact, he probably will get. He's the regional candidate, the Southwest. You need the Southwest to win. He's Hispanic. That's a significant voting block in the United States. He's he's a good guy. You know,
he's got a good
record.
He's got tremendous experience. He's got the diplomatic experience.
He's the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. I mean, he's
He'd be a very interesting vice president.
Yeah. So the question is it going to be Hillary and Richardson, or is it going to be Obama and Richardson, or is it going to be Edwards and Richardson?
I think it'll be Hillary and Richardson, but I think, you know, all bets are off after Iowa.
Yeah. Well, Hillary's speaking tomorrow morning at 8:30.
I can't wait.
And right now I have a tentative schedule conflict that I'm trying to change for that.
Change.
So, well, yeah. So, but you will let me know what happens.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah, because it should be very interesting. It seems to me that the biggest issue here is Iraq.
That's the sense I get. When I arrived, I wasn't sure whether it was going to be U.S. attorneys. Or whether it was going to be
I haven't heard
like
them mentioned
Gonzalez.
Once.
I haven't heard them mentioned once, which is astonishing to me.
Yeah.
I think it's such a huge issue.
Yeah.
But no, Iraq is the only issue with these people.
Yeah.
And they are passionate about it. We had Code Pink singing songs earlier on today.
Oh, I know. I had Medea here on the program just a little bit ago. Yeah, they're a force of nature, too.
Yeah, they are a force of nature.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, Bill Clinton did it too, you know, and so that's why we're doing it.
obviously not quite with that accent, but that's what Tony Snow had to say today about why the RNC illegally assign email addresses to members of the Bush administration to use for administration business, which is supposed to be, under the Presidential Records Act, is supposed to be absolutely sacrosanct, is supposed to be archived, is supposed to be totally available at all times. And it turns out when Tony said that, he said, and I quote, "Those email accounts were set up on a model based on the prior administration, which had done it the same way in order to avoid Hatch Act violations," end quote. When Tony said that, he lied. I know you're shocked. I understand. However, I guarantee you what he was doing, in addition to lying in that press conference, was setting up the talking points for all the right-wing talk radio hosts all across America. It's the new big lie. The fact of the matter is that in 1993, John Podesta, the assistant at that time to President Bill Clinton, issued a staff memo clearly stating that all emails coming out of his administration dealing with official business had to be, quote, incorporated into an official record-keeping system. In fact, this I'll read to you from the memo from the Clinton administration. Now, this is the memo, this is the administration that Tony Snow this morning is lying about. This from 1993, from John Podesta, in the Clinton administration. Electronic Presidential Records is the title of it. "Increasingly, presidential records may be created electronically. Records may be generated on word processing or electronic mail, email systems, or on electronic databases. Please note that nothing in this memorandum should be construed to override existing executive orders setting forth who may designate specific documents as classified and what terms must be used in connection with such designations. Records generated electronically must be incorporated into an official record-keeping system. Thus, no word processing or email document that is a presidential record should be deleted unless it has been A, printed and placed in an appropriate file, or B, preserved in an appropriate electronic system." Now, I am reading to you from the memo that John Podesta wrote for the Clinton administration in its first year in office in 1993 that Tony Snow this morning went before the press and lied about. The memo goes on to say, "Questions concerning the record status of electronically generated material should be directed to the White House Records Management Office. That office will periodically monitor accounting electronic systems to ensure the correct record status determinations have been made. As is the case for all record matters, the White House Records Management Office will continue to work with the White House Counsel's Office to coordinate policies and practices with respect to electronic presidential records." The Clinton administration made it very clear that email that came out of the White House, that email that had to do with presidential records, had to be archived, had to be maintained, had to be kept, had to be available. And Tony Snow comes out this morning and says, you know, a reporter says, "Tony, you've destroyed hundreds of thousands of these records. You've got, you know, some 50 members of the Bush administration who are running around using these phony RNC accounts and AOL accounts and heaven only knows what all. And isn't this a violation of the law?" Clinton did it. I mean, this is mind-boggling. As they note over at the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org, House investigators have learned that the Bush administration's use of Republican National Committee email accounts is far greater than previously disclosed. Karl Rove sent or received 140,216 of them through the RNC system alone. Now, this was a parallel system set up so that it would not be captured, so that the crimes being committed by this administration, and make no doubt about it, George Bush has been identified by a federal judge, Anna Dix Taylor, among others, as having specifically broken the law, a variety of laws. The crimes being committed by this administration would not be tracked, would not be, there'd be no record of it. This is, as I said yesterday, I think it was, this is Rosemary Woods on steroids. This is absolutely incredible. And so what does the White House say? Well, Clinton did it. No, he didn't. Well, the Clinton administration didn't. No, they didn't. Well, the people in the Clinton, they must have, I mean, you know, no, they didn't. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. During yesterday's press briefing, White House spokesman Tony Snow brushed aside direct evidence of potential illegality. This is in response to a House Oversight and Government Reform Committee report yesterday. This should be the top headline in every newscast in America. It should be the absolute top headline. I mean, right across the board. And, you know, how they get away with this? Well, we'll see. Are they going to get away with it? This is one of those areas where I really think it's worth a phone call to your member of Congress to say, these guys are committing crimes. We would like them prosecuted. Thank you very much. We want the investigations to go all the way through. We want to know what's going on. We would like them prosecuted. In other news, militants fired mortar rounds at the U.S. Guard at Green Zone this morning, with five of them striking near the office of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki at the same time that our generals and the administration are saying, oh, everything's fine. Everything's, you know, things are getting better and better all the time. Things are working out. Iraq is getting back to normal. And then Fred Thompson. And this is where it gets really and truly bizarre. Within the 9/11 truth community, there are numerous factions. And, you know, as I've pointed out the last couple of days, we are hearing from many of them, and have been all along, frankly. And I've had David Ray Griffin on this program, I think, three times in the last 3 years. We've had Alex Jones on this show. We've had conversations about the topic of, you know, what happened on 9/11. Or what might have happened on 9/11. Or what might have happened in the lead-up to 9/11. And frankly, in my mind, the biggest question is, what happened in the White House in the lead-up to 9/11? And within the 9/11 conspiracy community, for lack of a better phrase, there are some folks who believe that 9/11 was an inside job done by the Bush administration. They represent, I'm guessing, I believe, they represent a minority of the people who believe that 9/11 was more than just has been reported. And it's relatively easy in the mainstream political world to denigrate and ridicule these people. And that's what Fred Thompson is doing. And he's not just doing that. He's trying to suggest that Harry Reid is one of them. So, by the way, in response to the continuing avalanche of emails that I'm getting from people saying, I'll come on and debate somebody who says that there was no conspiracy on 9/11. David on our program a week ago said that he had talked to some of the 9/11 truth people and they did not want to come on and be debated. There are a few people that we've talked to who have said that they wouldn't come on and debate. The problem that we have is we can't get anybody from the other side. Well, I shouldn't even say that because we're working on it. So let me just say we're working on it. We're going to do an entire show on this sometime in the next couple of weeks and just try to bring as much light and air to this issue as absolutely possible. So, you know, thanks and no need to send me another 250 emails a day on that particular topic, particularly the emails telling me about all the other theorists who are wrong or deluded, but you've got the right theory. We'll sort that out. But in any case, Fred Thompson now saying that Harry Reid is arguing that, he says, Reid made his statement about General Pace on a conference call with fringe elements of the blogosphere who think we're the bad guys. Whether he means it or not, he's encouraging our enemies to believe that they are winning the crucial war of will. Fred Thompson. The guy must be taking acid. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I stand my ground, and I won't back down.
No, we're not going to back down, friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. Celinda Lake, a pollster and president of Lake Research Partners, is with us. Celinda,
hi,
welcome.
Hi, how are you? Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for showing up. Tell us, Lake Research Partners, first of all.
Progressive research-based strategy firm. We do polling, and we work only for progressive candidates.
That's great. You need to get just a little closer to the microphone so I can turn it down a little and we can cut down the room noise here.
Okay.
So in a way, you're the left-wing version of Frank Luntz.
Well, actually, we do a lot of that kind of work. We're looking at a lot of language and also trying to look at what progressive policies the public supports and how to get progressive candidates elected, including particularly women and people of color.
What are you learning?
Well, we're learning that the people have completely rejected the Republicans, but they still haven't hired the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And that what we really need to do is to fill in that brand, to tell people what we're doing and what we stand for. We're learning that people are very change-oriented, and we're learning that there's some important blocks of voters that could really determine this election. One of the most important changes in American politics is the tremendous sea change in unmarried America. 50% of households now unmarried, but they don't turn out to vote. And they're
particularly women, isn't it?
That's particularly women, exactly right. 23 million women who are registered and don't vote or don't vote, who are unmarried. They vote more than 2-to-1 progressive. So they could change...
If they vote.
So they could change politics if they turned out.
Yeah, so we had a guest on yesterday who's working specifically on that issue of getting those women out to vote, and it seems like a reasonable thing. It seems like step one is to make is to bring the issues home, to make it very clear to these women that politics is not something that just has to do with something out there and something in Washington, D.C.
And they often feel that politicians don't speak to their needs. And if you think about the typical political ad, it's a white male, married, wife there, two perfect kids, never look like they did anything wrong, talking about the marriage tax credit. And we wonder why unmarried women don't turn out to vote. So these are women who believe in a role for government but are very cynical about government and politicians.
Well, Rudy Giuliani has now produced two unmarried women.
That's right. There you go.
Discarded
and McCain a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
Fred Thompson,
yeah, he's on his second wife. I didn't realize McCain was divorced, is he?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, he was. Interesting. Of course, I guess for Republicans, even though they talk about that a lot, it really doesn't matter because Reagan had been divorced.
Right, that's right.
He was
right.
Our first divorced president.
That's right.
And just like George W. Bush is our first convicted of a crime president.
Good point, yeah, absolutely.
So being convicted of a crime, being divorced, those apparently not things that the Republicans care about. The Democrats, though, do have a series of issues that they care about. What are the ways, first of all, in summary, you know, the things that we hear about Iraq, health care.
Energy.
Yeah, these seem like the big issues. I mean,
the
absolutely powerful issues. What about the things that dance around the edge that really stir up the base, the activists? Things from, you know, trying to find out what happened with 9/11 to trying to find out whether Gonzalez and Rove, you know, broke the law with all of these, you know, 140,000 deleted emails and things, you know, the things where actually in court, I mean, you know, Judge Anna Dix Taylor in Detroit, federal judge, ruled that George Bush had broken the law.
Right.
And had violated the Constitution.
Right.
Which is a violation of his oath of office, which I would say is impeachable. None of these seem to have been raised to the level of national discourse. Why?
I think because, frankly, the issues of the economy and the war are pushing them out.
They're just so big.
And they're so big. They affect people so personally. And the grievances that people have about some of these other offenses also apply to these bigger issues as well.
But voters feel like, wait a minute, we fired the Republicans, but now we're looking about whether we should have hired you, and we want to know what you're going to do about it.
Right. But, you know, I think back to Bill Clinton being impeached over lying about sex in the White House, which I think in the context of everything that the Bush administration has done now, we would consider laughably small as an issue. Are you suggesting that one of the things that set the stage for that was that he had done such a good job of managing the government that there was peace and prosperity?
Ironically, I think that's right. Voters really overall aren't that supportive of impeachment right now. They're worried about the disruption. They don't really understand it. And we must remember that voters at the time didn't support impeachment of Bill Clinton either. So I think that what voters really want are change that will affect their lives. They want to know, how are we going to get health care costs down? How are we going to get energy prices down? Why don't you go after Halliburton? Why don't you go after energy companies? How are we going to get our vehicles armored up to avoid mines in Iraq? How are we going to get these troops home?
So keeping to the bigger issues is what's going to win for Democrats.
And the pragmatic issues that affect people's lives in a direct way. I think that the other thing is, you know, George Bush is a lame duck president anymore.
Right. We can't run against him.
Right. And voters have kind of retired him. And so when we talk about impeaching him, they go, he's not going to be there anyway. We're counting down the days. So it makes us feel good. But what voters want to know is, what changes are you going to bring to my daily life and to this country's future?
Yeah. And that really is the bottom line. Celinda Lake, a pollster, president of Lake Research Partners, lakeresearch.com, one of the Democratic Party's leading strategists. Am I hearing the music? Yo, okay, there we go. All right, thanks, Celinda.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. David Sirota sitting here with me, one of my favorite bloggers, writers, political activists. David, it's an honor to sit here with you.
It's an honor to sit here with you, Tom.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Your mic is a little hot there. You're moving from Montana to Denver, Colorado.
That's right. We just completed the move. I drove the length of the state of Wyoming, and I can attest to you personally that there's not a lot of people there.
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah.
It's been 30 years, but I've done that. Yeah. There are a lot of issues. In fact, we were just talking with a Democratic pollster, and she was talking about the big issues are energy, the war in Iraq, you know, these kind of home issues. Seems to me, though, that one of the issues, and immigration, seems to me that one of the issues that is, to a large extent, flying under the radar of anybody except the political activists is trade.
Mm-hmm.
This whole idea, I mean, the United States, from the founding of this country until really Reagan started dismantling it and Clinton blew it totally apart, the United States, in the founding of this country, had this notion that if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in Pittsburgh, and you want to make those shoes in Mexico, that's fine. We can't stop you from doing that. But when you bring them into this country, and there's 20 cents worth of labor in Mexico, when you bring them into this country, there's going to be an 80-cent tax. Tariffs paid for 100% of the federal government from the founding of the country to the Civil War, 66% of the federal government from the Civil War to World War I, a third of the federal government from World War I to World War II. I mean, this is how we built manufacturing in the United States, was with tariffs. And these guys have just ripped this thing apart in 26 years. What do we do?
Well, I think the first thing has already been done. I actually do believe that at a very visceral level that more and more of the public understands that if not exactly trade, this whole thing known as globalization is just not working out very well for the average American. And so I think that we've already achieved the consciousness we need to achieve to get change. I mean, we still need to continue to build that consciousness, but I actually think we've reached a point where people realize that something's wrong with the global economy and how it's working for them. I mean, this is one example. Right. Part of the reason why somebody like Lou Dobbs, love him or hate him, has gotten the ratings that he's gotten has to do with a very visceral sense among the public that something's wrong with the global economy.
Sure.
Now, I don't necessarily agree with all the prescriptions Lou Dobbs preaches.
We're all getting screwed. I mean, everybody knows it. I mean,
exactly. So how do we change it? Well, the challenge is to channel that consciousness into pressure for specific changes. And I would say that the easiest change to have in a Congress is to stop something. So ultimately, in the short term, what we can hope to change is to staunch the bleeding.
Right.
We're going to have a series
stop
of
all these crazy trade agreements that are coming down the road.
Let's just stop for a second. And we got a bunch of trade pacts coming down the pike, and I am really convinced that if people get in touch with their lawmakers and say these trade pacts are not acceptable, do not vote for them, we will have a halt on the ones coming down the pike. And that would be a huge step forward from the autopilot we've been on for the last
year. Because basically what we have is a trade policy that screws Americans, it screws the average worker, it screws people in foreign countries
Absolutely.
As well, those workers, they're exploited, and is making billionaires and multi-billionaires out of the CEOs and the owners and the stockholders of the largest transnational corporations. I mean, that's just the bottom line. It works to the benefit. People talk about, oh, we're afraid of one world government. Well, you've got it. It's in the, you know, you can name 50 corporations.
That's right. And the issue is, you know, the question is the economy supposed to work for society, or does society work for the economy?
Yeah, as Sir James Goldsmith opened his book, The Trap, with.
It's really, really true here. Do we continue to pursue a quote-unquote free trade policy in pursuit of an economic theory, or do we pursue policies that serve the vast majority of the public? I mean, it's really nobody really debates anymore whether our trade policy is working for an exclusive few. It's just, I mean, even the proponents of free trade don't really try to pretend that our trade policy has done anything but exacerbate wealth inequality throughout the world. And so the question is, I think the challenge after we stop the bleeding, because there still is bleeding, the hardest question will be, okay, how do we build the consensus to move forward with a positive vision of what a new trade system should look like?
How do we take it to
the
next
step? That's very difficult.
And that's going to be a challenge. Ned Lamont is here. Let's bring him in on this conversation as well. I know you and the two of you have worked together.
We sure have.
Hey, Ned. Great to have you here. You need to get right up on this mic here.
Hey, Sirota. Stealing all
hey,
my
Ned.
Thunder?
All of it.
he's doing his best. Ned Lamont, what are you up to these days?
Well, I tried to end the war for the last 18 months, taking on Joe Lieberman. Since then, I've been teaching up in Cambridge, setting up a policy institute in Connecticut to help our fair state deal with universal health care and a couple other big issues that have fallen on their plate.
I am hearing stuff coming out of Lieberman's mouth that is causing me to wonder, I mean, genuinely wonder about his mental health. And you're smiling, but I'm quite serious about that. And I'm wondering, at what point are the citizens, are the good citizens of Connecticut going to say, hey, wait a minute, we know we gave him 6 years, but, you know, 6 months into it, it looks like we made a huge mistake. Let's initiate a recall.
Well,
or another election.
We don't have recalls in Connecticut, but it is time, I think, for the Democrats to stand up and challenge him. I think right now he's in the catbird seat, and everybody's being too cautious with him. You know, he just got back from Iraq, and yet again, like he does every 6 months, announced all the great progress we're making with the surge. He's obviously talked about the bombing mission in Iran. I think it's time for the Democrats to be clear. I want the presidential candidates to stand up and say, this man does not speak for our party. He speaks only for himself, and he's wrong in the biggest issues of the day. He will make the world a more dangerous place.
Yeah, indeed. What political future for Ned Lamont?
Well, time will tell. I'm staying involved, obviously, in the issues that I care about up in Connecticut. And we're going to be doing some teaching as well.
Yeah.
You know, not many of these people leave that often. I mean, they stay in office forever, at least in our state. It looks like an old black and white photo of the Politburo when you look at our elected leaders. But if there was an opportunity, I definitely want to contribute.
Yeah, good. Because, you know, we need people of your caliber out there and of the concerns that you have.
Sure, Rod, I never heard you so quiet.
Yeah.
Well, what can I add about Joe Lieberman? I mean, this is a person who continues to be terrible on all the major issues. I think that the question that I always had during Ned's campaign and now is whether the Democrats are going to stand up to him. I think they're still afraid that he'll
become a Republican.
He'll become a Republican. Now,
but see, if he becomes a Republican, they change the rules of the Senate.
Right. Of
course. So it, you know, the Democrats will still hold the seats. Now, help me understand here. Do they still hold the chairmanship seats?
Yes.
Through this Congress and into the next,
into the next one. And I think, but my theory about this is that all of those threats are absurd, because if you know Joe Lieberman, or I think what motivates that person is a desire for attention. Once Joe Lieberman becomes a Republican, that's the last day he gets any attention, because then
the Republicans start trotting him out like they did Zell Miller. He becomes the new, you know, the new.
Yeah, but the moment Zell Miller never changed. But the moment it became really clear that he was a Republican was the moment he became really irrelevant. The moment Joe Lieberman switches. That's I'll put it in a different way. The moment Jim Jeffords switched was the last moment Jim Jeffords really got much attention.
Well, I lived in Vermont when he switched, and the state exploded.
When he switched.
Thank you, Jim, bumper stickers all over the place.
When he switched.
Oh, yeah.
I'm talking about 2 months after he switched.
Right.
Maybe in Vermont people were still thanking him, but on the national stage,
right,
it was a boomlet.
Yeah.
And I think reason Joe Lieberman gets so much attention is this perception that the Senate is so split so evenly, and he supposedly holds the balance, even though we know in the rules he really doesn't hold the balance.
Yeah.
And so I think he'll never actually switch. And so the question is when will the Democratic leadership and the Democrats in the Congress just basically say, look, not only are we just not going to deal with him, but we're going to actually go out there and say he does not speak for us. Because I think the real problem, the danger of Joe Lieberman, at least politically, not necessarily for national security, the danger for the Democrats politically is that people get confused that he does speak for them.
Yeah, we have just a minute left. Ned Lamont, to what extent is this kind of conversation going on in Connecticut?
I think there's a lot of buyer's remorse in Connecticut. But what can we do now? We don't have to sit around waiting until 2008. I think now is the time to be putting pressure on guys like John Sununu in New Hampshire and Susan Collins in Maine and Norm Coleman. We've got a big vote coming up over the course of the next 90 days that's going to determine our future in Iraq. And I think now is the time to put pressure on those Republicans who are wavering on the fence. As soon as they start feeling the pressure, I think we can start putting together this bipartisan consensus to end the war. So I'd urge all of your listeners to find those pivot states and see how they can weigh in. We made a little difference in Connecticut, but we got another opportunity. We don't have to wait till 2008.
Yeah, that's a very good point, to get out there and be citizen activists. It's not enough to just vote. You've got to show up. You know, it's just not enough to just vote. Boy, is that something really loud there. Ned Lamont, David Sirota, davidsirota.com, the website. Ned Lamont, you have a website these days?
We got nedlamont.com. We're bringing it back.
There you go.
We're going head-to-head with Sirota.
We'll see who can
lose that one.
We can see who can get the most hits out of this one. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being here with us.
My pleasure.
Great talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears. The president kicked democracy out the door, and he shifted off to a foreign shore, giving birth instead to a holy war. I don't know why those Iraqis got so sore. We only killed 100,000 or more. It's called collateral damage when you're waging a war. Bringing democracy back.
Amen. It does. It does begin with you. And we have a, for lack of a better word, a winner in our who posted the blog post that David thought was the best one of the day. And congratulations to Sing Sing, who blogged over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. And the title of the post was, "You almost nailed it with Agnew." Almost. And then the post was, "The perception of a victorious surge in the autumn, followed by redeployment in the spring, will indeed make Operation Iraqi Liberation a success. Except for the million killed, the millions more with vengeful retribution planned for their occupiers and their countrymen, and the oil sharing agreement that Chalabi is in the middle of and that the Kurds are not buying. So what noble cause did Cindy Sheehan's son die for? The frame should now be endless occupation and later Pentagon or peace. Where should your tax dollars go? $700 billion annually into the Iron Triangle or to restructure the VA hospital system? Incentives for biodiesel and solar? Expand Pell Grants for vocational training and higher ed? Opt in for Medicare for all? Reduce prison population and state costs by commuting nonviolent to LoJack and converting prisons to office parks? Recycling the used steel for 18-foot electric fences around Cheney and Bush's ranches where they can be restricted after being impeached locally and convicted of war crimes internationally? Good blog, Sing Sing." Just a little bit of passion there. Good one. Bill in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom Hartman. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I don't think you can get better, but you're just great.
Thank you.
At any rate, Congressman Kucinich was here in this fair city, and we were also very impressed. When someone in the room asked him the question with regard to Building 7 at the World Trade Center.
Right.
And would he be willing to look into reinvestigating that? The congressman, true to his political animal nature, gave a routine answer. It was unacceptable to me, that answer, and I piped up. And I said, "Congressman, that answer is unacceptable. It's unacceptable because you know as well as I do that the greatest sin ever perpetuated on this nation is the fact that we were led down the garden path. And furthermore, you know that we deserve the truth, no matter what that truth is, no matter where it leads." Now, the congressman really, he amazed me. He reflected for a moment, and then he turned and he asked the room, "Do we need to reopen the investigation with regard to the events of 9/11? I couldn't believe an American congressman asked that question in public.
Sure.
The room, Tom, gave the congressman a resounding yes.
Yeah. I believe I've said it on the air. I've certainly said it enough times. In my mind, 9/11 is this generation's Kennedy assassination.
I think it's part and parcel of the Kennedy assassination. I think it's a continuance.
It may even be some of the same old players.
Yeah, well, you know, when the buildings fell, someone in the room said to me, "I remember when they were all with Nixon, don't you?"
Wow.
Tom,
yeah.
It's time for it all to stop.
Yeah, no, and it's time for us to get some truth and to get to the bottom of it. You know, Building 7 is not, to the best of my knowledge, mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. My questions, frankly, I mean, I'm getting, as I've mentioned on the air, I'm in the middle now of this spitting war, I guess, to say it in a way that you can say on the radio, between people who are arguing that it was done by this group versus it was done by that group versus it was done this way versus it was done that way, and you know, all this kind of all in the middle of it. And I think that we all, as a nation, and I suspect probably many Americans are in this place. I mean, you know, look at the studies that were done back in the mid-60s, and, you know, do you think that Kennedy was killed by a lone assassin? And, you know, typically a majority of Americans would say no.
You know, Tom, you and I have spoke before. You called it my heart thin. I call it my 3-cent solution. It's my way to open up the dialogue with people. They ask me, "What's that?"
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm amazed. Sophia spoke about it as well on Jeff Ferris' show here in Phoenix. The big answer to when you confront people and you ask them, you know, could it be another Reichstag fire? Could 9/11 be an inside job?
Well, it was a Reichstag fire. The question, they're
right,
still debating whether
the
Reichstag fire was done by the brown shirts or whether it was just Marius von der Lubin.
But my point is, the answer that you get more often than not, the number one answer is, people tell you, even if it was true, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Well, it goes beyond that. And this is where I think a good and thorough investigation should go. And that is not just How did the Bush administration, how is it that Condoleezza Rice knew? I mean, you know, Bush was moved out of Italy onto an aircraft carrier because they had a warning that bin Laden was going to hijack a plane and crash it into a building in Italy that Bush was staying in.
Right.
How could they have ignored this? How could they have, you know, totally dropped the ball on this, A? And B, how did they exploit this to take down the Constitution of the United States? I would like to see a methodical, step-by-step analysis of that. I think.
We already know the answers.
Well, you know, a lot of it is pretty apparent, Bill. I agree with you. And a lot of it still has not been laid out. And we will not know until we have some serious investigations. There were several, three, four different serious investigations. The Kennedy administration still didn't, assassination still didn't get to the bottom of it. We've just begun on this. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman broadcasting live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. on Air America Radio. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.